All right, welcome everybody, 1024, and this is the Thursday meeting, our last meeting for the week of Chem 3. It is now Thursday, June 18th, and wow, we made it to the end of the week. Pretty exciting. We've covered a good bit of material, and we've got some more to do today in terms of dimensional analysis. So we've gone through all the sig figs rules. We've gone through all the numbers. Dimensional analysis is a big topic in and of itself. And I know that we just did one or maybe two examples. I didn't look back. I should look back to see exactly where we ended. But the one thing that I didn't get to do with dimensional analysis is there's something that I want you guys to memorize. And so this is a component that we'll start it off and we'll header this as 1.6. So this is chapter 1.6. And it's dimensional analysis. But what this textbook does, and what many other textbooks, almost all textbooks do this, and it's a reasonable thing to do, they give you tables of conversion factors. And those tables of conversion factors, I'm looking to see if I see where they have, in 1.6, I'm sure they have a table that's in there that is nothing but conversion factors. They have a table 1.6, which is common conversion factors. And then I thought they had even a larger table than that. Table 1.6 is actually pretty truncated, and that's better than most books do, but it's still pretty big. So table 1.6 has probably 412 different conversion factors. Within the book. And I find that handling that many conversion factors is complicated. That's a lot to memorize. And I always try to reduce down the amount of memorization that I have in a class. That if you can take the memorization and reduce it down and internalize a smaller number of things, you can be more successful. And so what I have is I have what I call my three keys. And the three keys are three key conversion factors. Those three key conversion factors take you from English units of measure to SI units of measure. And we have one for length, we have one for mass, and we have one for volume. And those conversion factors are length that 1 inch equals 2.54 centimeters. We have in mass that 1 pound is equal to 453.6 grams. And for volume, 1 gallon is equal to 3.785 liters. These three conversion factors, two of them are measured. One of them is a definition. So two of them have sig figs associated. The other one is a definition where inches and 2.54 centimeters are defined to be exact. And these three conversion factors, length, mass, and volume, allow you to do almost every single problem in the book without having to memorize all the rest of the conversion factors. Sometimes you do need one. Sometimes there's some obscure conversion factors, like you may not know how many feet there are in a mile, and that would be really helpful. Or sometimes you don't know the pints to quarts to gallons conversion factors that are in the English system because they're all obscure, and how many pints are there in a quart? How many quarts are there in a gallon? And if it's something that is like that in a problem, I will give it to you. Most of the time I go back and forth because I'm used to, having in-class exams where they're closed book and closed note and the things that I want you to memorize. And this is an open note, open book test, but I want to caution you that even in an open book, open note test in this format, the answer that I'm looking for is going to be related to the things that I'm going to ask you to memorize. And so I would want you, or I do want you, to memorize these conversion factors. And I want you to use these conversion factors and the other conversion factors that I'm going to give you in preference of things you may look up. So please memorize these three. And having these in your working memory is going to really help. And you're going to see that it's a lot easier to have these memorized and to do almost all the problems that we're going to do than it is to constantly go back and look for a conversion factor. The other thing is these conversion factors, we said this one was exact, but these have four sig figs down below. And the four sig figs help in that most of the equations that we wind up doing wind up being three or four significant figures. And if you have a conversion factor that you've memorized to four sig figs, then the conversion factor doesn't truncate your answer at all. The conversion factor, what truncates your answer is the input data that winds up going into it. And so these are really helpful conversion factors. Let's take these and show how we might use these and do just a couple of problems. So I had three problems that I had written out that I wanted to try. And they are in varying degrees of complexity. And yet they each highlight out some different sorts of skills that I want to do. So let's start with the simple one. Number one, let's do these as example problems. What I want to do is I want to convert 3.75 miles into a distance in kilometers, into kilometers. And along with this, what we'll do is we'll give you a conversion factor that says that 1 mile is equal to 5,280 feet. Not a conversion factor that most people have memorized, nor would I expect you to memorize that one. And so we're going to go through, we had this whole system and we developed a system by which we were going to do these types of problems. And the first thing was to parse our word problem and to find the given. So the given here is 3.7 miles. And to find our desired, kilometers is our desired. And to start writing out our roadmap by taking miles and kilometers and setting them on opposite sides to be able to go through and write out our roadmap. And what we have here is a conversion factor that was given that I'm assuming is going to be used in the problem that gives me miles to feet. And so one of the things that I like to do here also is I like to think about what type of units I'm in. I'm in an English distance, and I want to go to an SI distance or SI length. Maybe I should say it is length because our key is in length. And the conversion factor that I have for that is a conversion factor that takes me from 2.54 centimeters, or 1 inch equals 2.54 centimeters. And as I take that key and think about that key really is an English to SI key. And so that English to SI key is probably going to fit in here at this point, where I'm going to go from centimeters to inches, and I can think about a bridging point where I transition from English to SI. And that key conversion factor helps me to make that bridge. And now what I need to do is I need to fill in the gaps in the rest of the way. And usually once you find the bridge, the rest of the gaps fill in a little bit easier. And so you work in a way that is non-linear. Most students want to start with miles and just start going and drawing the roadmap. But I find that if you try to do that, sometimes you get stuck and you don't know how to proceed. If you start with thinking about what it is I need to achieve, what is the bridge that I need to cross? Once you get across that bridge, other sides become easier. For instance, centimeters. Now I can take to meters and then to kilometers. You could go directly from centimeters to kilometers if you wanted to, if you knew what the conversion factors were, but sometimes it's easier to go to the base unit from something that is smaller and then go to the above the base unit to something larger. That's always easier. Miles to inches, that's a tough one, except I've got miles to feet. And so if I go miles to feet, then I can go feet to inches and I know what those conversion factors are. And so now the roadmap is complete. And once the roadmap is complete, you're 90% of the way there to solving the problem. Now all we need to do is follow the roadmap. So in following the roadmap, I'm going to take this roadmap and move it down the page just a bit so that as I move to the next page, I can still see my roadmap. All right, we needed 3.75 miles. So we're starting off now at 3.75 miles. We follow the roadmap and we put miles in the denominator because we want them to cancel. I always start by putting the units in without the values. Feet are my first desire. And then I go back and I look at that conversion factor. 1 mile equals 5,280 feet. 5,280 feet go with the feet conversion, 1 mile in the denominator. I'm now in feet and I need to go to inches. Feet will go in the denominator, inches in the numerator. For every 1 foot, there are 12 inches. That's a conversion factor that we should be able to write out and have in our head. So we have canceled feet. We're now in inches. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to cross that bridge. I'm going to cross the bridge from inches to centimeters, and I'm going to use the inches equals 2.54 centimeters. Inches go in the denominator. Centimeters in the numerator, and for every 1 inch, it's 2.54 centimeters. Now I've canceled out inches and I'm in centimeters. I'll go from centimeters to meters. Centimeters in the denominator, meters in the numerator. For every 100 centimeters, it's 1 meter. I've now crossed off centimeters. I'm in meters. The last thing I'll do is I'll go to kilometers. So meters in the denominator, kilometers in the numerator. And it takes 1,000 meters to equal 1 kilometer. Meters have now canceled. I've got 1 unit of measure and it's in my numerator. And I've accomplished my goal of going through and setting up this equation just by following the roadmap. So we'll punch it in now. 3.75 times 5,280 times 12 times 2.54 divided by 100 divided by 1,000. So the way that I entered that, 3.75 times 5,280 times 12 times 2.54 divided by 100 divided by 1,000. I'm doing it that way because everything that's in the denominator, I'm doing divided by. It's just an easier way to be able to enter the keystrokes in, that everything in the numerators, going across the numerator, you hit multiply, and everything in the denominator, you hit divided by. And it's not that you have to do it that way, but that's kind of the way that I prefer to just do my calculations. That's the way that I think about it. And this answer came out to be 6.03504 kilometers. And now, of course, the last step in that process that we had written out was to go through and do the sig figs. 3 sig figs in my starting value. Maybe you guys could tell me how many sig figs there are in the 5,280 feet to a mile, considering that those two are in the same English system of measure. Be careful, I just clued you in there. Those are in the same system of measure. Definition, exactly. Because in the same unit of measure, those are defined units. So it's a definition. So it's not that it has zero sig figs, it has infinite sig figs. it's a little bit different. When we say something is a definition, we're saying that it's not going to truncate the sig figs. It doesn't affect the sig figs. So it's not that it has zero, but infinite is the way that I tend to think about that. Inches to feet, another definition. 2.54 centimeters to an inch. This is the one of the three keys that is a definition. The other two are measured, but this one is a definition. And then 100 centimeters in a meter, again, within a unit of measure, a definition. And meters to kilometers, again, a definition. So all of these were definitions, except the beginning entry value that had three sig figs. So I round the answer to three sig figs. This is going to use, this was a tricky one, this is going to use the greater than five rule. It is not exactly five that's at the tail end here. I have 504. The 04, something other than zero, beyond the five, means that this five is bigger than five, and I'm going to round up. So we're going to use the round up rule for greater than five. So the answer is going to be 6.04 kilometers. Okay, how did that go? Everybody feel good with that roadmap sort of approach and that idea of building a roadmap and this idea of spanning the gap and getting across that bridge between different units of measure is an important sort of idea of how do I cross that bridge? Where do I cross that bridge? Let's look at another problem. So, second example. This example gets a little bit more complex. Let's convert 0.632 gallons per hour into milliliters per minute. And so we've got a leak, essentially, of half a gallon or almost half a gallon, 6.632 gallons per hour. And we want to figure out how many milliliters per minute that leak actually is, or that flow rate. It's one way to do it. And so so what we're going to do is develop a roadmap. And this roadmap is going to be a little bit different. Let's parse it first. We always talk about parsing. Let's give our given. So here's our given is in gallons per hour, and our desired is in milliliters per minute. And instead of writing these out as a diagonal slant when I create my roadmap, I'm going to write it out this way. I'm going to write out gallons over hours. And on the other side, I'm going to write milliliters per minute. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to treat this as if it is two roadmaps. It's a roadmap in the numerator and a roadmap in the denominator. So I'm going to create two different roadmaps, essentially. And for some reason, everything seems like it's going at an angle. Oh, all right, leave it alone. It wants to be the way it wants to be. Okay, so if we think about what we're doing here, we're going from an SI or an English. I usually do blue for English. Let's do an English volume. And over on this side, I'm going to an SI volume. So I'm going to use the volume key in order to be able to bridge that gap. And so at some point over here, I'm going to transition into SI from English. And I need to figure out what that key is. And that key is that I can go from gallons all the way over to liters. In fact, this arrow, I can do a much bigger arrow than this because I can go all the way from gallons to liters. And then from liters, I can go to milliliters. This is why I wanted my roadmap to be straighter. It's killing me that my roadmap's not straight. I'm going to make it straighter. So much better, just easier to follow. Okay, we have a numerator and a denominator. So we've got the numerator figured out. And in the denominator, we've got to go from hours to minutes. And that's not so bad either, because we know that there's a conversion factor that does take us from hours to minutes, that there are 60 minutes in an hour. So I have a roadmap in my numerator, and I have a roadmap in my denominator, and I will follow each of these, and I'll show you how we'll do it. So we're going to take our given, that is 0.632 gallons, and we will write that over 1 hour. So instead of just writing it over the unit, I write it over a value of one. And I'm going to multiply. And let's show that we're working on the numerator first. So if we think about this sort of as the numerator component, and then down here we'll do green for the denominator component, I'm going to work in the numerator first and do my numerator conversions first, meaning that I'm going to go from gallons to liters. And for every 1 gallon, this is a conversion factor that we asked you to memorize, 3.785 liters. That is one of the three keys that I've pulled out. So that was a memorized conversion factor. And I've gone now from gallons to liters. Now I need to go from liters to milliliters. So for every, let's go, we'll go liters to milliliters. For every 1 liter, it's 1,000 milliliters. And I've now accomplished the roadmap for the numerator. Now what I need to do is I need to work on the denominator. And the next conversion factor that goes in, I want hours to cancel with whatever goes on over here. So somehow I need to get rid of the units of hours. If I want to cancel hours that are in the denominator, hours are going to have to come up and be in my numerator in order to cancel them. So I'm going to start off this one by writing hours in the numerator and my desired minutes in the denominator. And that is going to allow hours to cancel and get minutes in the denominator. Now I just need to apply the values. For every 1 hour, it's 60 minutes. And that was a conversion factor that worked the roadmap for the denominator. If I do a little unit analysis now, and I look at what my unit analysis is, gallons, cancel with gallons here. Liters, cancel with liters there. Milliliters don't cancel with anything, so the milliliters stay. Hours, canceled with hours in the numerator at the end, but the minutes do not cancel with anything, so the minutes stay. That means that my final answer, when I print this answer or when I calculate this answer is going to have units that are going to be milliliters per minute. And that is the answer that I was looking for, was milliliters per minute. And so I've shown now that this roadmap approach can be extended to a roadmap in a numerator and a roadmap in a denominator. And I can deal with multiple conversions at the same time, that the whole roadmap idea is expandable to other types of problems that have multiple units in them. So this is definitely an added complexity when you add in multiple units, but the same process actually allows us to be able to handle that. So when we go through and we put this calculation in, it's going to be 0.632 times 3.785 times 1,000. Divided by 60. .8686 with a repeating 6. Okay, am I done with that problem? What do I got to do now?
Sig figs.
Sig figs, exactly. Yeah, so we got to go through and do sig figs yet. All right, so we changed to purple. Go through and do sig figs. There was 3 sig figs in the 0.632 gallons. There are 4 sig figs in the 3.785 liters to a gallon. 1,000 milliliters to a liter is a definition. And 60 minutes to an hour is a definition. So it looks like my smallest is 3. So I need to round this answer to 3. And the answer comes out to, let's see if I can fit that in there. I don't know if that'll fit in there. I'll just leave it there. The answer comes out to 39.9 milliliters per minute. And you can leave it written as a straight up and down line, as a slash, excuse me, or a horizontal line. Either way is correct in terms of writing that answer. But our answer has the right number of sig figs, and we've shown now an extension of this roadmap and how we can do this roadmap, both in the numerator and the denominator. How did that go? Did that bring up any questions? Is that looking okay? Everybody able to follow that? Okay, let's try one more problem then. These are one of my favorite problems that I like to do.
I have a question.
Go for it.
Would it matter which conversion you do first?
No, it does not. I could have converted the denominator first, and then I could have worked on the numerator. And that is absolutely true. I always tend to do my numerator first and then go through and do the denominator. But no, doesn't, the order does not matter. Okay. Alex, this is how we usually calculate density. This is one way in which we calculate densities, or we could calculate a density. We're going to use a density in the next problem. Usually the calculation of density involves the measurement of the mass and the measurement of volume. And those are not done in a dimensional analysis sort of way. We could like change the density from grams per milliliter to some other measurement, pounds per gallon. We could figure out what the density is in pounds per gallon or some other sort of unit like that. That would be a problem like this, is a conversion of density into other units. But generally, the actual calculations of densities are not problems that are dimensional analysis problems. They are just, they're a straight up math problem where you take a mass and divide it by a volume. And they don't tend to get as complicated as this. So we've done a lot of densities in lab. Here, we're actually looking more at not the calculation of density, but how do we use density? So this next problem is going to be an example of how we use density. Okay, and this problem is more complicated in that, there's just a lot going on. So let's say that you are an aquarium enthusiast and that you desire to bring into your home. Why does that not? Sometimes it just doesn't do what I want it to do. You're desiring to bring into your home a new aquarium, and you're going to set up a 1,000-gallon aquarium. Or not 1,000, 100. Let's set up 100. 1,000 is like really big. And we're going to assume that this aquarium is going to hold 100 gallons, and that this is going to be a saltwater aquarium. And that we just want to be concerned with how much the water is going to weigh in here. And we know that the density of salt water is going to be 1.23 grams per milliliter. So there's our density. And the question is, where you're going to install this in your house, how many pounds is this thing going to weigh? Just for the water itself, excluding the glass. We could take and we could add the glass into it. We could give you the mass of the glass and just tell you how much glass is. But the water is going to weigh so much more than the glass is going to weigh that we're going to just calculate out how much this aquarium is going to weigh. And so are we going to need to reinforce the floor of the house in order to hold this 100-gallon aquarium? Or is the cabinet going to hold this 100-gallon aquarium that we want to do here? The other sort of problem that I like to do like this is also a hot tub. What if we had a hot tub and how many gallons is the hot tub going to hold and how many pounds is the hot tub going to comprise when we put and fill it up with water? And of course the density is given to us in grams per milliliter. So we've got to parse this problem and we've got to take, and I haven't written out in a full word problem. I've sort of already drawn you some images to give you an idea of where we sit. 100 gallons is our given. And we're going to make this 100 with a decimal so that this is going to be a 3 sig fig value. So I'm going to highlight that right now. That's 100 to 3 sig figs by including the decimal. And my question that I'm asking, my desired is pounds. How many pounds? So on my roadmap wise, what I've got to do on my roadmap is I've got to get from gallons all the way over to pounds.
Jason, quick clarification. If it doesn't have a decimal, it's 2 sig figs?
If it doesn't have a decimal, it would be 1. So if I write the value and I say that the value is 100 and we're saying gallons, this would be interpreted as 1 sig fig, just the 1. If it is 100 with a decimal gallons, it is interpreted to be 3 sig figs because the zeros are considered captive zeros. If I write it 1.0 times 10 to the second gallons, now I've found a way to write it as 2 sig figs. So we could write it either 1, 2, or 3 by those different methods.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Okay. So we've got to get from gallons to pounds. And this is an interesting thing in that we have been given an English volume and we're desiring an English mass. However, the conversion factor that we were given that is 1.23 grams, let me turn it around and say that 1 milliliter equals 1.23 grams. This was my density. And density is a volume to mass, or the other way around, mass to volume conversion factor. And that's what I'm doing over here, is that if I think about this in terms of coloring sort of the sides and saying that maybe we have volume over here, that we're going from volume and mass on this side, we can see that I've got a bridge that I've got to cross, and that bridge takes me from the volume side to the mass side. And this is my conversion factor that I have to accomplish that, which is kind of crappy. Whoever wrote this problem was not very nice to you because they gave you a conversion factor that was all in SI. And so we've got the density and we can go and bridge this gap, and we will bridge this gap going to grams and milliliters, but these are SI measurements. And so I've got to be able to get from gallons in English to SI volume. So an English volume to an SI volume, which means that I'm going to have to pull in the three keys in order to do this. So let's just quickly write down what those three keys were again to be able to help us. The three keys were 1 inch equals 2.54 centimeters. I may not need that, but 1 gallon is equal to 3.785 liters. I'll definitely need that. And 1 pound is equal to 453.6 grams. I'm going to need the gallons and the pounds conversion factors in order to resolve this problem. So I'm going to go from gallons over here first to liters and then to milliliters. So the gallon, I'm going to use the gallon to liter key. This is one of my three keys that takes me from gallons to liters. The liters to milliliters, this is an SI prefix conversion factor. The milliliters to grams, this is my density that I'm using there. Now I've got to get from grams to pounds, and grams to pounds, fortunately, that is just a single conversion factor. That is another of my three keys that allows me to go from grams to pounds. Okay, so one of the key things that I'm trying to do here in terms of writing out the roadmap is thinking about what are the transitions that I'm doing? How am I going from volume to mass? What is my volume to mass conversion factor? How do I span that gap or cross that bridge? And the density allows me to cross that bridge. And then again, I have yet to make a roadmap in a linear fashion. If you've watched every time I've written out a roadmap, I have done it non-linearly. I start by crossing the bridge and then I fill in the left and fill in the right. So sort of the idea here behind constructing a really good roadmap, what is the bridge you have to cross? What is the conversion factor that lets you cross it? Fill in the left and right sides. That's the approach that I'm taking a lot of the time. Find the bridge. What conversion factor allows you to cross it? And let's say equality. And then fill in left and right sides. So that's sort of our key to doing some of these roadmaps. I don't know if you all find that helpful. I find that helpful. The more processes I can give you, the more checklists you can create and kind of go through and do for these types of problem solving, the better. So I always try to make it a system as much as I can. All right, we've got our roadmap. Let's take it and let's follow it. So I'm going to copy this roadmap. I probably should have grabbed my conversion factor that was there. But I can go back and grab that. And we'll grab our equalities that are here. So we're going to need this density. And we're going to need these keys. So we'll bring them all in together. And now we've got, I think, everything we need. So there's my list of equalities that I'm going to use as I go to throw this thing together. Okay, we're starting off with a 100-gallon fish tank. It is 100 with a decimal, indicating 3 sig figs. My first step is to go from gallons to liters. So gallons goes in the denominator, liters in the numerator. And the key for that is that 1 gallon equals 3.785 in terms of liters. I have now crossed off gallons and I'm in liters. Actually, I start to get lazy because I want to go faster. but I should just take the time, switch colors, cross it off, make it good. Next step, I'm going to go from liters, and on my roadmap, I go from liters to milliliters. So I make sure that I follow my roadmap, and then I go from liters to milliliters. That is an SI conversion factor that there are 1,000 milliliters in 1 liter. So that should be in my head, and I should be able to do that. And we have now successfully canceled out liters, and I am now on this step in my roadmap, and I'm about to cross that volume to mass bridge using density. So I'm going to go from milliliters to grams. So the next step is to go from milliliters to grams. And that density was that 1 milliliter equaled 1.23 grams. That crosses off milliliters, and I'm now in grams. So now, one last step, grams to pounds, in my roadmap. So I want grams to cancel. That means I'll have to put grams in the denominator, pounds in the numerator. Notice that I'm not putting values in until after I put in the units. It's easier to put the units in first, make sure they cancel, then go back and figure out where to put the values. It's just easier that way. So now I go back and I look at my key. 1 pound equals 453.6 grams. The 453.6 goes with grams. So that's going to go in the denominator. 453.6 grams to 1 pound. And grams has now canceled. I am left with 1 unit of measure, and that 1 unit of measure is in the numerator. And so this answer, whatever this answer is going to come out in pounds. Now we just punch it into the calculator, and then we'll go back and we'll check sig figs. So we're going to do 100 times 3.785 times 1,000 times 1.23 divided by 453.6. That is 1,026.35582 pounds. Going back and checking sig figs. 3 sig figs, we said, for the starting value with the decimal. Liters to gallons is a measured quantity. It has 4 sig figs. 1,000 milliliters to a liter is a definition. 1.23 grams to milliliters. That's a density. What do you think about sig figs for that density? Are densities measured quantities?
Yes.
Yes, they are measured quantities, which means it's going to have 3 sig figs. Good. And the 453.6 to pounds, this is different units of measure. This is English to SI. So this conversion factor is a measured conversion factor. And the units, or the sig figs, are carried in this time in the denominator in the 453.6. So that is 4 sig figs in that. Sometimes I get the question about, well, what about this 1? Why doesn't the 1 carry 1 sig fig? And the answer is that when they aligned those rulers, what they did is they did something like this. They did like 100 pounds. They did something like this, 100 decimal pounds aligned to, 45,360 grams. And then they went through, this was 3 sig figs. This was 4 sig figs. Maybe I ought to just make it into a 4 sig fig value. So I'll give it that. They aligned these two rulers, and when they did the division, they got it's 1 over 453.6 pounds to grams, And the way that that worked out was it was 3 sig figs and 4 sig figs, or I could change this one now to 4 is what I did. And so the sig figs are carried here in the denominator. The 1 is just a placeholder for the unit. So in these conversion factors where there is a 1, the 1 is not a sig fig. The 1 is a placeholder for the unit. That's all it really is. So when they aligned the rulers, they used much larger values that allowed them to get the 4 sig figs, and the 4 sig figs then are carried in the reduced fraction. And they're carried either in the numerator or the denominator in the value, but not in the 1. I hope that's clear. And so the number of sig figs that I carry then, it looks like my smallest number is 3, which happens in multiple places. And so I will round this answer off to 3 sig figs. A little bit of a tricky rounding. We are rounding the value of 1026.35582. We're rounding it to 3 sig figs. And so this value is going to round to 103, but then I need to include the 0, and that is going to be in pounds, and that is a 3 sig fig answer. The other way to represent this, 1.03 times 10 to the third pounds. Those are the two ways to represent that answer. The answer is not 103 pounds. Okay, so how do I explain this? When you round this off, why do I need to go back in and put that 0 back in there? Let's say that you had $1,000 in the bank, and or what you had in the bank was $1,026, and you asked the bank teller, how much money do I have in my account? Just about. I need a round estimate of how much money I have in the bank. And the teller told you, oh, you have 103. You'd say, no, I don't. I have 1,000. When you round this off, if you think about money, you'll make less mistakes. When you round this value off as 1,000, it needs to have the value of 1,000, which means that we can't just drop that and put a 0 and then not show it and write 103. It needs to have the value of 1,030. Not 103. And so the rounding there, a lot of people will make this mistake. They'll round it to 103 and not understand why they're making the rounding error. The problem there is that you've dropped off the 0, and so you've changed the inherent value of the number that was there. So be careful of not making that mistake. So anyway, that fish tank. That 100-gallon fish tank weighs approximately 1,000 pounds, 1,030 pounds, which is probably way more than you think that that 100-gallon fish tank might weigh. But it's kind of a nice example that shows that knowing nothing more than the SI units and the density of the water, we can go and we can calculate out what the mass of that fish tank actually is, how many pounds that fish tank actually is. And understanding the 3 key conversion factors, where did I write them? They're up here. Understanding those 3 key conversion factors allows us to do many of those transitions as we go through English to SI, which is why I like those 3 keys. And I think that those are really good to memorize. In fact, I'm going to ask and require you guys to memorize those 3 key conversion factors.
Now, something that doesn't pertain to us in this instance, but that, like, if you were an engineer designing this situation for a client, so to speak, you'd have to factor in the accuracy of actually filling up a 100-gallon tank to exactly 100 gallons, correct?
Yeah, Jeremy, that's a good question. And that's why I said when I defined the problem that I think if you go back and you listen to what I had said, that I'm going to assume that the fish tank is going to hold 100 gallons when it's not filled all the way to the absolute top. I'm going to assume that it's going to hold 100 gallons of water. And that is an assumption. And an engineer or in an engineering sense, I would have to take into account the mass of the glass. I would have to take into account the mass of the water and any filtration system, because a lot of times these aquariums have big filtration sump pumps underneath them as well that hold an additional amount of water. So, and I also need to account for a worst case scenario of how much water they could actually fill into that entire thing. What is the max water that they could put into the entire system from an engineering standpoint and the weight of the cabinet? So yeah, I'd want to catch all of that. But yeah, that's a good question. And that's why I try to be pretty specific when I word these problems, that I want you to focus on this amount of water and how much water that's going to weigh. But yeah, those are all things that would need to be taken into account. Exactly.
Yeah, I think that just crossed my mind because you, like, I guess if it were a client, like, you'd have to factor in the variability that, like, maybe they would overfill it or underfill it or something. But that, like I said, it doesn't pertain to us. That just, it crossed my mind.
Yeah, and Jeremy, there's another good question here. What if it was a freshwater aquarium, right? So what if somebody is using freshwater versus saltwater? How does that actually change the mass of how much water goes in there? And so that's another factor, is that we could look at it. What is the difference between the mass of a saltwater aquarium versus a freshwater aquarium? And you'll find that the density, because the density of water is 1 for freshwater, but 1.23 grams per milliliter for saltwater, it makes a pretty substantial difference. I mean, it's a difference of a couple hundred pounds in terms of the weight of the water. So that's an interesting aspect there too, that the density is really important in terms of what is the density of that saltwater.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, any other sort of questions come up? Because I think we're at the point here, we're reaching about the hour mark. This is a good point to take a break. And I want to hit any questions that came up on this before we launch into temperature conversions after the break. So we'll make a distinction here. We'll stop doing unit conversions for a bit. We'll go and we'll talk about temperature conversions because those are a little unique. But if anything came up, I want to hit it before the break. And if not...
Jason, I have a question about when we use the numbers in expanded form, like when you did the 100 decimal and 100 and then 1.0 times 10 to the second. Is there like equations where we'll need to write it that way?
Sometimes when you want to hit the right number of sig figs, sometimes you'll have to put it into scientific notation. Let me see if I can create one to show you. Let's say that the answer that to a problem came out to 1300.6. Actually, let's make this a number here. Let's make this a, this a four. No, four. That was close. Not an eight. I want a four. 6327 pounds. And I want to round to 3 sig figs. Okay, so how do I round this to 3 sig figs? This would be my rounding spot. I'm going 1, 2, and 3. So that means that I need to round this, and because I'm rounding to the 4, the 0 stays. So this becomes 1300 pounds. But written this way, this is 2 sig figs in terms of the way that we would interpret that. And if I were to include the decimal pounds, this would be 4 sig figs. So if I really want it to 3 sig figs, the only way to get there is to write it 1.30 times 10 to the third pounds. And now that is my way of getting 3 sig figs. And that's the way that I would have to write the answer. There's no other way to write it.
So it just kind of depends on how many sig figs you want.
It's situational. It completely depends on the value and how many sig figs are required.
Okay, and when we're writing out the equations, like when you did 100 decimal, because you wanted 3 sig figs, why specifically did you want 3?
Because I wanted 3 when I designed the problem, that I wanted 100 gallons. I wanted a nice round number because that's a common aquarium. And for me to say 103 gallons would be ridiculous, even 110. So I wanted 100, a nice round number, but I wanted it to have enough sig figs. I wanted it to have 3 sig figs in order to have the problem be meaningful.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
All good questions. Anything else come up for anybody?
I had a question. This doesn't really have to do with this, but
Okay.
I was struggling on the homework, and I was wondering if I could review it during office hours with you.
Absolutely, Autumn. I'm going to jump into office hours at 3:30 after the lab, and I will be in office hours from 3:30 until 5:15.
Okay.
I've been getting people that jump in periodically, and we just take turns if there's multiple people in there, but absolutely. Jump in on office hours at 3:30. The link is in the email. Okay. I can send that link out again. Maybe I'll do that this afternoon so that people see it again. That will help people to be willing, more willing to jump into office hours if they need help. But absolutely, that's what office hours are there for. Anything that, any sort of work or help that you need on the homework or on the labs or anything that we've been doing, that's a great time to sort of cover all those bases and cover all those questions.
And we don't have a lab that we have to do yet, do we?
Not yet. I was trying to program that damn lab in and it beat me last night. Yeah, it's like painful. I don't even want to talk about it. I had it almost entirely done and I lost an hour and a half's worth of work at midnight and I was frustrated. So I went to bed. But I'm going to get it. I'm going to beat it. I am better than Canvas. I can do this. As demonstrated with some of those other things that I've already created, we can do this. All right. How about we go take a break? You guys all good now for a break? All right. 10-minute break. We'll come back at 11:30 and we'll do some temperature conversions. I'll put some music on.
One more question for the homework.
Yeah. Go ahead, Anna. Oh, Anna, you're on mute. Your microphone's muted.
I'm having problems with homework and the writings of the, so question three, how are we supposed to write that? And like, is that the proper way to write -6 in the middle of nowhere down there after the 10, because it's already in there?
So because you're on your cell phone and that would be the right way to write it in. The problem is that when it's on a computer, it's formatted correctly, but because of the size of the boxes, it's breaking the formatting. And so if you look at it on a computer, it would have been formatted as a superscript, but yes, that is what is intended to be done there. It just was not intended to be done on a cell phone. It's the limitation of Canvas and what Canvas can actually do.
Okay. Thank you. I just questioned about that.
Yeah, that I can see that would be very confusing. And that was something that I was worried about, was people doing this on mobile. That is a limitation that I feel that I could deal with on my own website that I can't deal with in Canvas. Canvas limits me to the size of the boxes and the formatting. And I always knew from the moment that I started doing that Canvas was going to blow the formatting. Canvas was created, I don't know who created it, but I can tell you that Canvas was really created by somebody who had in mind doing multiple choice types and true false type questions. And from a, I'm sure not a scientific background, I'm sure that they were looking at creating this particularly for the social sciences, for English and for all of those other subjects, not math, not chemistry, not physics. It really is a poor environment for dealing with that type of material. And I think more than anything, Canvas was probably designed by a publishing company who decided that they were going to cash in because the community colleges, the four-year universities, the Cal State system, all of them buy into Canvas and pay Canvas to utilize those services. And it's just a publishing marketing scheme to cause us anguish. I just hate that. I hate marketing in all of those ways. I'd just much rather teach and design my own materials and my own equipment. So anyway, I apologize, Anna. That's just a formatting being blown based on doing it on mobile.
And so yeah, I would do it on my computer, except I'm doing most of my schoolwork at work and I can't exactly bring a computer to work.
Yep, I hear you. I think that's why we're all trying to be as flexible as we can. And yes, the intention there was for the second box to be a superscript. And I think that is the only exercise where I really do that, is in that exercise. The rest of them should be just one box and one answer and should be much more straightforward. Okay. All right, I'm going to take a break myself. I got 6 minutes. I'm going to go stomp around and get out of this chair for a few minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll do some more. And I'm going to put some music on. Let's see, how do I do that? Screen share. Continue. That's going to blow out the screen share for that one. Share that and music. Oh, stop sharing. So complicated. Oh, it got even more complicated. How do I ditch out of this now? Wow, did that get complicated?
You never thought he played that much, and now it's more than all his cards you want. is sinking low. Well, I've been sad,
sad to know.
But I've lived long enough to know that I don't want no one to cry for me. Oh, when they
carry me up,
oh, when they
lay me down,
oh, when they bury
me beneath the ground,
I want my people,
people in the street
doing that
same line of me.
And I don't want no one to cry for me. Oh, when my
time is
oh, when my
race is
oh, when my
sun is sinking low.
Well, I'll be sad,
sad to go.
But I've lived long,
long enough to know
that I don't want no one to cry for me. Oh, when they
yeah,
I want my people,
people in the street
doing that
second line beat.
I don't
want no one to cry for me.
There we are. Let's come back. Let's see, what do I need to do? I need to screen share the iPad. And go back to our notes. All right, so where we're gonna pick up now as we come back into session is we're gonna look at temperature conversions. Temperature conversions are a little more difficult than the other type of conversions that we've been doing. And we need to look at temperature to understand why. Let's start a whole new page here. Temperature conversions. We have three different types or three different systems for temperature. What we have is we have degrees Fahrenheit. We have, actually degrees Fahrenheit should be written. Let's do it this way. We have degrees Celsius and we have Kelvin. So the Fahrenheit system, oh, can I spell Fahrenheit? I don't know. Close, but probably not correct. Celsius, Kelvin. The various systems were created at different times and created in different ways. And it was the Fahrenheit system that was the first system that was created. And the Fahrenheit system, I believe, oh gosh, I want to say it was created in the early 1700s. I can't remember the exact time frame in which it was created. But what they did is they based the Fahrenheit system on the boiling point of water and the freezing point of water. And they said that the boiling point of water was going to be 212 degrees Fahrenheit and that the freezing point was going to be 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And so that there are 180 divisions within the Fahrenheit scale. And the Fahrenheit scale goes down into negative values. and it doesn't really have a bottom. They never thought of it as having a bottom. It just had positive values and negative values and 180 divisions, we'll call it, in that scale between the boiling point of water and the freezing point of water. And I think that really came about is, if I remember correctly, and I have not read this in a while, but it's a long time ago, that the Fahrenheit system was really built based on body temperature and an equal number of divisions between body temperature and the freezing point of water. And then when you take that up to the boiling point of water, that gives you the 180 divisions and where the 212 point comes from. So I don't think that they were actually trying to set that 212 mark at the boiling point. I think they picked a nice round number, which was probably the 100 degrees or the 98.6 that we think of as body temperature. So that's where the Fahrenheit scale came from. Then came Celsius, and Celsius decided that what we needed was a scale that was based on the boiling point and freezing point of water, but that had nice round numbers. And so Celsius chose 100 degrees Celsius for its boiling point of water and chose 0 degrees Celsius for its freezing point of water. And it had a nice round 100 divisions. And it also goes down to negative values. And at the time, did not really think about what those negative values might be or how far that scale might go. So the two scales have different divisions, different numbers of divisions in them, and they also have different zero points. For instance, the zero point down here is at 0 degrees. Oops, that is not what I wanted to grab. The zero point down for Fahrenheit is 0 degrees down here, is below freezing. That is not degrees Celsius, that's Fahrenheit. 0 degrees Fahrenheit is below freezing and is a very cold value before you start getting into negatives. And so the zero points are at different locations in these scales. And they also have a different number of divisions. Then when we got to Kelvin, what Kelvin said was that Kelvin was going to make an absolute zero scale. And they were going to set 273.15 divisions between the zero point, the absolute zero, and the triple point of water. The triple point of water is sort of this freezing point here, and this gets set at 273.15 Kelvin, and there are no degrees in it. And Kelvin goes down to an absolute zero. So we'll go down here to absolute, meaning that there are no negatives. So there's no negative values in terms of Kelvin. And there was 273.15 divisions between that absolute and the freezing point of water. And then there are 100 divisions between 273 and 373.15 Kelvin at the boiling point of water. And so the number of divisions here between the Kelvin scale and the Celsius scale, that the Kelvin scale and the Celsius scale are very similar in their numbers of divisions. But the Fahrenheit scale having its 180 divisions makes it more complicated. Now, being in the United States, being in the English system, which Fahrenheit is the English system, we do almost all of our temperatures in Fahrenheit, which is a total pain, because to convert between Fahrenheit and Celsius or Fahrenheit and Kelvin is a complicated conversion. It's not a straightforward conversion. We have both what is called a unit shift, a division shift, and a phase shift to be able to take into account in order to do the conversions between Fahrenheit and Celsius. Celsius and Kelvin is easy because Celsius and Kelvin have the same divisions. They just have different zero points. So first, let's do a Kelvin to Celsius conversion. Kelvin to Celsius. Or Celsius to Kelvin. What we do is we take the Kelvin value and we subtract 273.15, and that equals degrees Celsius. Or we can go degrees Celsius to Kelvin, and we take the degrees Celsius and we add to it 273.15, and we get Kelvin. So the Kelvin to degrees Celsius is easy. And it's pretty easy to remember and pretty easy to use, because all you got to do is do the zero shift. So this part is easy. It's just the phase shift, because the units are the same, or the divisions are the same. But now when we go from Fahrenheit to degrees Celsius, or degrees Celsius to Fahrenheit, it gets a little bit more complicated. Let's go degrees Celsius to Fahrenheit first. Degrees Celsius to Fahrenheit. What we need to do is we need to take our degrees Celsius, and we need to think about this in terms of a unit shift. There are 100 divisions in degrees Celsius and 180 divisions in degrees Fahrenheit. That converts the degrees Celsius into Fahrenheit units. But then, if you think about it, if I take 0 degrees Celsius, let's go back up and look on the scale for a second. If I take 0 degrees Celsius and I divide by 100 and multiply by 180, what is 0 times 180 divided by 100? 0 times anything is 0, right? So if I took this and I just did that conversion, I would go down here. But I don't want to go down here to 0. I have to go to 32. So I have to do the phase shift to get me to 32. So if I'm at 0 degrees Celsius, I divide by 100, multiply by 180, then I have to take that result and add 32 degrees to it in order to get up here where I'm supposed to be at the freezing point of water. So down here, what I have to do is I have to add 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and that will equal my degrees Fahrenheit. Now, what most people do is they take this 180 over 100 and they reduce it down to like 9/5. I never remember because I don't do it that way. I always think of it, I always rebuild it from scratch in my head. I always think about the number of divisions that are there and just rebuilding it from scratch. And so I think that 180 divided by 100 is the 9/5 math fraction in our 9/5. So this reduces down to degrees Celsius times 9/5 plus 32. And that's where that equation comes from that they quote in the book. I like to know where an equation comes from rather than just multiplying by 9/5. To me, it makes more sense to understand the number of divisions and to think about this as a dimensional analysis problem with a phase shift at the end. That's the way that I like to think about that problem. So it's a unit conversion with a phase shift at the end and results in this nice pretty formula. How do we go from degrees Fahrenheit then to degrees Celsius? To turn this formula around, if we're going degrees Fahrenheit to degrees Celsius, I first have to take my degrees Fahrenheit and do my phase shift. I have to subtract 32 degrees Fahrenheit from it to do the phase shift first. And then I have to multiply that by the unit conversion, 180 degrees Fahrenheit over 100 degrees Celsius. And that will give me degrees Celsius. And this equation gets reduced down. Degrees Fahrenheit minus 32 times 5/9. And that equals degrees Celsius. And that's the simplified version of the equation. So which equation you want to use is entirely up to you or how you want to think about this. I'm just trying to header these out. Thinking about these as just separate equations. Whichever way you want to do this is up to you. And which equation you want to memorize. I always sort of stick and memorize with 180 over 100 plus 32 and the other one minus 32. And then be careful with this though. You got to put this in parentheses. This is something that's really, people make a lot of mistakes in this. That mathematically, let's say that mathematically what I want to do is I want to take 103 degrees Fahrenheit and I want to convert it into Celsius. I would take minus 32 degrees Fahrenheit and then I have to multiply it by 5/9. This has to be done first with parentheses in the calculator. The correct answer out of this is 103 subtract 32 times 5 divided by 9. The correct answer is 85 and it's 3 sig figs. So we'll keep 3 sig figs. That goes in, that goes out. 85.2 degrees Celsius would be the correct answer. If you make a mistake and you leave the parentheses off, 103 degrees Fahrenheit, subtract 32 times 5/9, if you throw it into your calculator this way, it will do this part in parentheses and then do the subtraction. And this is not correct. We need to be careful of doing it this way. 103 subtract 32 times 5 divided by 9. The calculator, that is no way that that just did that wrong. I did it wrong the first time. Ha, I made my own mistake. 103 subtract 32 times 5 divided by 9. This should be 34. Good thing I caught that. This should be 34.4 degrees, and the incorrect number is 85.2 degrees Celsius. So what's happening there is that by order of operation, if you leave the parentheses off and you forget to use the parentheses, order of operation says do multiplication and division before you do subtraction. So the calculator will take the 32, times it by the 5, divide by 9, it'll take that result and it will subtract it from 103. If you leave the parentheses off, that's what happens. When you input this into your calculator, it's really critical that you do the subtraction first, get that answer, or put it in parentheses, then do the multiplication to the 5/9, and you will get the correct answer. I hope I clarified that.
I got 39.4 for some reason.
No, you're right. I'm reading the calculator wrong. I slipped when I wrote it. Either in my mind or with my glasses. Thank you, Edgar. Okay, now we're set. It's one of those catastrophes that is not always bad. It's always good for you guys to see me as human. It's just not bad when I constantly do it, if I do it constantly to make mistakes. In any case, so what we have shown is we have shown how to convert from Kelvin to degrees Celsius or degrees Celsius to Kelvin. That's an easy conversion, plus or minus 273.15. We have now shown how to convert from degrees Fahrenheit to Celsius and from Celsius to Fahrenheit. That's a more complicated equation. The equation that they give you in the book uses the 9/5 value. There's nothing wrong with that equation. That's a great equation to go ahead and use. The only question is, what happens if I want to go from degrees Celsius or degrees Fahrenheit to Kelvin? How do I go through and do degrees Fahrenheit to Kelvin? This is not a typical conversion. The way that I like to do this is I like to go degrees Fahrenheit to degrees Celsius and then add to it to go to Kelvin. If I'm going backwards and I'm trying to go from Kelvin to degrees Fahrenheit, then the way that I approach that is I go from Kelvin to degrees Celsius by subtracting 273.15. And then I go from degrees Celsius to degrees Fahrenheit. And I always just go through degrees Celsius. We can develop another equation. I'm going to spread these out this way. We certainly can develop an equation very much like the degrees Celsius to Fahrenheit equation, but it's one more thing to memorize. So why memorize one more thing when I can just go through and do it this way? That's generally the answer that is given. So we can develop a new equation. There's really no point in doing that. This is easy enough to go through and do it this way. So that's what I recommend. Okay. So temperature conversions are a little bit different than the rest of the dimensional analysis stuff. And we could just do a quick couple of examples. Examples. Convert 23.6 degrees Celsius into Kelvin and degrees Fahrenheit. So we take the 23.6 degrees Celsius and we will add 273.15 Kelvin in order to get them together. Actually, we don't have to put the Kelvin there. We're just adding 273.15. This is going to equal 5.7.692. And based on our sig figs rules that we have followed, the uncertainty resided in that position, in the tenths position. So we should round this to the tenths position based on the rules of addition and subtraction. And so the actual answer that we would report here would be, this is going to be the round even rule because it's exactly 5. So this is going to equal 296.8 degrees, not degrees, just Kelvin. Kelvin has no degree symbol. It is just Kelvin. So 296.8 Kelvin. In converting the 23.6 into Fahrenheit, I would take the 23.6 degrees Celsius. I'll multiply it by the, I can't even do it by the 9/5. It just, my brain just doesn't want to do it. I'll divide by 100, multiply by 180, and then I will add to it the 32 to do the phase shift. And that's going to equal 23.6 divided by 100 times 180. Get that answer at 32. This is going to equal 74.48 degrees Fahrenheit. And we should think about this in terms of sig figs. This answer had 3 sig figs that went into it. And the answer over here should likewise have 3 sig figs. This value that we're adding is an exact counted value, because the degrees are counted. It is a division and there is no part or no partial division in terms of the degrees. And so it is an exact counted values. These over here, the 180 by 100 is also exact. So whatever sig figs go into this are the number of sig figs that come out of it. So these conversions between degrees Fahrenheit and degrees Celsius are exact conversions. Sig figs in will equal sig figs out. So we will round it to the 3 sig figs coming out and we would report 74.5 degrees Fahrenheit would be the value that we would report there. How did that feel in terms of temperatures? I know that's a little fast, a little brisk, but I think we got a hold of it on temperatures. So there's not a whole lot more in terms of temperatures. That's really the extent of what it is that we look at doing with temperatures. And temperatures into the other unit conversions don't generally play into the other unit conversions. They'll come back again when we get into gas laws. They'll come back again, where else beyond gas laws? I think they come back in into rates, into some of the rate equations. Temperature comes into play and stuff in Chem 1A and Chem 1B, not generally in Chem 3. In Chem 3, it's usually just straight up conversions of temperatures going back and forth between Celsius, Kelvin, and Fahrenheit. Okay, so that gets us out of chapter 1 and into chapter 2. And we've got 20 minutes to talk about chapter 2. We won't do a whole lot, but I think chapter 2 is kind of exciting. It is a lot of fun stuff talking about atoms and early atomic theory. My thought process in this, in looking at chapter 2, is that the history part is the fun part. The history part is where you get to learn how did they figure all this stuff out. However, the history part is not the useful part within chemistry. The useful part is really, all right, how do I make use of this theory? What is the computational component that I need to do, the math part that I need to be able to do to go through and do these components? So I really do want to go through some of the history stuff and how this is designed, but I'm not going to ask you very many questions in that. So I don't want you to memorize dates. I don't want you to memorize people's names. I don't want you to memorize these theories per se and how they were developed. I'm not going to ask you questions on that. I'm really going to stick to the mathematical type of questions, or also the size of the subatomic particles. That sort of gets to be important. But I'm going to be very clear about where I want you to memorize things and where I don't. So don't spend a lot of effort trying to memorize all of this history or the dates or the people's names and all of that stuff. Is that clear in terms of what we're focusing on? Okay, because I want you to make sure that you put effort where effort is needed and not where it is not. So I want to be clear about that. Okay, so in chapter 2.1, we start with early atomic theory. And this is where they really start to get to the idea that there are atoms and that atoms are a thing, that are an indivisible thing of matter. It's the smallest piece of matter that we can get to that still has the properties of the bulk material, is the way that we say that. And this was really done by Dalton. And Dalton is sort of the father of atomic theory. And Dalton came up with this around 1807, which is amazing that they had no tools to be able to look at elements, or to even be able to begin to think that elements might be a thing. And yet Dalton was able to come up with this. And many of Dalton's ideas are still valid. So what Dalton said was that matter was made up of atoms and that this was the smallest unit of an element, essentially, that could participate in a chemical change. So within Dalton's idea of atomic theory, he said that the smallest division was atoms and that these atoms, or these things that he called atoms, were the smallest unit that could participate in a chemical reaction. He also said that an element was made up of one type of atom and that there were no other types of atoms, that the atoms were unique to an element. So that elements were a single type of element, or of atom. That the atoms of different elements were different. That's what he's really saying. Atoms of different elements are different. All of these are still true. So there's nothing wrong with this theory. It's just that we build upon this theory. The third thing that he said was that atoms, elements of one type of atom have all the same property. Elements of one type of atom. I want to turn this around. Atoms of one element. That just means that the atoms of that element are all going to be identical, that they all have the same properties. His fourth idea was that compounds were made of two or more elements in whole number ratios, and that whole number ratios is the really important part. Compounds are made of two or more elements. In whole number ratios. It is the whole number ratios that is unique there, and the idea that an atom is indivisible and therefore can only be in whole number ratios. What it says is atoms are counted values. This is important. Being counted, it means that they don't have sig figs applied to them in that way, in these whole number ratios. These whole number ratios are exact. There's no fractional ratios. That's a great thing. The other thing that he said is that a compound always has the same ratio, that the ratio doesn't change. The compound ratio is fixed, meaning that it is always the same for that compound. What does that mean? It means like water, H2O, is always in the same ratio, two hydrogens to one oxygen. And that if you change the ratio, you change the compound so that they are always found in this 2-to-1 ratio for water and never different. And his fifth idea is that atoms are never created or destroyed in a chemical reaction, that matter is conserved. It is the conservation of matter idea. Conservation of matter. That atoms cannot be destroyed or created. In a chemical reaction. I'm going to apologize. My gardeners are here, and when the gardeners are here, my dog goes ballistic. It's just the way of the world. I cannot get him to accept the gardeners. It's like they're invading his territory and they're taking his lawn and he just freaks out. Somebody is stealing the lawn and we need to do something about it now. It is an emergency. It's just the way it is. And leaf blowers are the enemy. Leaf blowers are to be destroyed at all costs. It doesn't matter how far away the leaf blower is. It needs to be destroyed. All right. So that's Dalton's law. I mean, those are Dalton's ideas of early atomic theory. And all of these ideas are still valid and true. And he came up with this theory early 1800s, 1807. And there's another idea that came out of Dalton that is a little bit more complicated. We don't often talk about it within Chem 3. It's more that it comes up within Chem 1A. But the more I think about it, it's a foundational idea that goes to the idea that that these fixed ratios, how did Dalton come up with these fixed ratios? This idea right here, that atoms are counted and in fixed ratios, in whole numbers, and where did that idea actually come from? And it comes from what is called the law of multiple proportions. Gotta check our time, see how we're doing. This is a complicated idea. And it says that when two elements react to form more than a single compound, more than one compound, a fixed mass of one element will react with the other element in a ratio of small whole numbers. I'm going to write that down and then we'll show an example. So this law of multiple proportions says that when two elements form a compound, and it's not just a single compound, it's more than one, to form more than one compound. A fixed mass of one element will react with the other element in a ratio of small whole numbers. Okay, I'm gonna leave that there, try to leave that there so you guys can get that written down while I explain what this means with an illustrated example. When I mix copper and chlorine. So if I take copper and chlorine, the symbol for copper is an uppercase C and a lowercase u. And I react it with chlorine. The symbol for chlorine is C, capital C, lowercase l. These two make two different types of compounds. One of these compounds is brown, and one of these compounds is green. The difference in color between the two compounds distinguishes them as being unique, and that they have different ratios of copper and chlorine that are making them. Okay, and when I take and I combine the copper and the chlorine, for instance, if I take 1 gram of copper and I combine it with 1.116 grams of chlorine, what I wind up getting is the brown solid. If I take 1 gram of copper and combine it with 0.558 grams of chlorine, what I get is the green. They look physically different despite their color. I mean, even though their color is different, the crystals look entirely different. They are completely different looking materials. They have different boiling points. They have different melting points. They have different physical properties. So these compounds are different. What happens is I'm using this idea of a fixed, so I say a fixed mass of one element. I guess I can highlight it there. That fixed mass of one element is the 1 gram of copper. That is my fixed mass that I'm doing. And I'm reacting it with the other element. So what I do now is I take these ratios and I say that I have 1.116 grams of chlorine divided by 1 gram of copper. And I put that over 0.558 grams of chlorine over 1 gram of copper. So I'm dividing essentially the brown solid and looking at how that is related to the green. But in essence, they have the same amount of copper that are in them. And so the copper is dividing out. This is giving me a ratio that is a whole number ratio, a 2-to-1 ratio. And what that's saying is that the chlorine is combining with the copper in a particular way such that one of these compounds is, I would do this right here, the green solid. One of these compounds is CuCl, and the other compound is CuCl2. And that 2-to-1 ratio is highlighting the ratio here that is a 1 as a subscript for the chlorine. So if I choose this out and sort of do it this way, that this 1 ratio that is here is telling me about that green solid and how much chlorine is being used in that green solid. And the other ratio that is here, that is the 2 ratio, that is telling me about how many chlorines are in that brown solid. And that it is a whole number and it never comes out to a fraction. And this was the idea that gave Dalton the idea to say that they combine in whole number ratios. It was that experiment that allowed him to say that every time I do this, I get whole number ratios. And I can do it for many different compounds. It's not just copper and chlorine that do this. This experiment can be repeated for other things like iron and chlorine, or iron and oxygen, or nickel and chlorine, and nickel and oxygen, or nickel and nitrogen, all of these different elements. Every time they did this experiment, they got whole number ratios. And it's those whole number ratios that are telling us that, that they're combining in whole number ratios. That's one of the really important outcomes that, that Dalton discovered and is called the law of multiple proportions. So what that tells us is that atoms are indivisible. And because of their indivisibility, those atoms combine in whole number ratios, and that those ratios are consistent always for the same type of compound. And so that a compound will always have a fixed ratio, and that ratio will never vary. I think I'm making my point. At least I hope that's coming clear. I know that these ideas are complicated in that they're abstract. We can't see compounds. If we could just look at the darn things and we could understand that, and it would be easy enough, but you have to understand that these were discovered without ever being able to see an atom. And yet they were able to do experiments that showed them what these ratios were, and that they always came in whole numbers. And that developed part of our atomic theory. From there, we step into chapter 2.2, and we look at the evolution of atomic theory. And I don't think I want to jump into that because we got 5 minutes left in class, and I think this is a good stopping spot. And we can jump into the evolution of atomic theory on Monday, and we'll go through J.J. Thompson's experiments with the cathode ray tube. We'll look at Robert Mulliken's oil drop. We'll go into Rutherford's alpha particle experiment and Soddy's Nobel Prize for the development of isotopes. And then we'll get back into the mathematical description of what the atom is, and we'll look at the size of the nucleus. We'll look at the size of neutrons and protons and electrons, and we'll look at isotopes, and we'll look at all of these different things where we'll start to put a little bit more math to it, and we'll get back into the things that I really want you to focus on in math. But the history is fun, and the history is exciting, and it really gives you a sense of how this progressed and where these things come from. So anyway, let's open it up for questions. Let's see if you guys have any questions that you want to do. And if not, we can cut it here. Go for it.
Yeah. Does it matter how it's written with CuCl1? Could it be Cl1Cu? Does the order matter?
The order does matter. The order is actually really important. And yet that doesn't happen until chapter 3. that we start to get into that, or chapter four. But yes, the order is really important, because what we do is when we list compounds that are, these are ionic compounds. Ionic compounds have a cation and an anion. And so what is happening here is that the copper is forming two different types of cations. There is a copper which is a plus one, and there is a copper which is a two plus. And the chlorine has a single negative charge. And so the way that the chlorine combines, the way that these compounds combine, is they combine in a way to neutralize the charge, such that the charge is zero, essentially, combining to form a copper and a chlorine and a copper and two chlorines. But we always list the cation first, the positively charged particle first, the negatively charged particle second. And so, yes, there is an order to the way that they are presented.
That makes sense. Thank
you. Yeah, exactly. Good question. And again, we'll get into that later in other chapters. We first need to get through this atomic theory first. Then once we get into atoms and we understand atoms, then we can talk about ions and the creation of positive charges and negative charges. And then how do we write these compounds? And then how do we name these compounds? And it's all a linear progression, all built on one another. So yes, great question. Thank you. Anybody else? Alex.
Jason, I had a question about the homework problems. Well, there was one that was one of the suggested problems that asked the difference between a homogeneous mixture and a pure substance. And I was kind of thinking about that, and I was a little confused as far as like what actually is the difference between the...
That's a great question. I love that question. Okay. So homogeneous mixture versus a pure substance. Okay. A homogeneous mixture is by definition uniform. So when we think about this as uniform, the pure substance is also uniform, meaning that the pure substance, no matter how small you divide it, you get the same ratios of things. They are both uniform. So in that, they are similar in that they are both uniform. But let's think about a homogeneous mixture where I could take a couple of different containers, and let's do beakers rather than flasks. I could take a couple of different beakers, and in these different beakers, I could have different mixtures of salt water. And so all of these being homogeneous, I can take and I can put into this 100 milliliters of water. So the amount of water that I'm putting in and the amount of salt, NaCl, sodium chloride, that I'm putting in. I can put in 0.5 grams of salt. I could have 100 milliliters of water and I could put in 1 gram of salt. I could have 100 milliliters of water and I could put in 1.5 grams of salt. And so the ratios can change and yet still be homogeneous. So all of these, all homogeneous. But varying ratios. And so that's a mixture. A pure substance, sodium chloride, NaCl, is a pure substance, and they come in a 1-to-1 ratio that never varies. It's never 1-to-2. I can't change the ratio in a pure substance. The ratio in a pure substance is always fixed, or we should say here, ratio fixed. So one has a varying ratio, the other one has a fixed ratio. Does that help to highlight it, Alex? Cool. Yeah, that's a subtle question, but it's an important question. It's what defines a mixture versus a pure substance, that a mixture can have varying ratios while a pure substance has fixed ratios. Great question. I also love these questions because it just shows that you guys are thinking, you guys are on top of it. You guys are invested in it. I love that investment. That investment is to be celebrated for sure. Anything else? All right. I'm going to remind you guys that I've got office hours from 3:30 to 5:15. I'll send out an email when I start office hours just to remind you guys and send out that link again so you guys can jump into office hours. And if there's nothing else for today, let's call it a day, and I wish you a great weekend. And if anything else, if I get anything else up on Canvas or any other exercises, I don't anticipate any other exercises, but I might try to start getting some homework plugged in for chapter 2 so that anybody who's wanting to work ahead can jump into that and do that. And I'll also notify you or let you know when I get those lab things up so that you guys can do that as well. All right. Other than that, I think you've got your assignments. You've got your work cut out for you. You know what you need to do for chapter 1. Stay on top of it and have a great weekend. And for you guys in the afternoon, I'll see you in the afternoon lab.
Thank you, sir.
All right. You're welcome.